Greetings, troubled listeners. Welcome back to the Troubled Men Podcast. I'm Renee Coleman, sitting once again in Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge in the heart of the Klempire, with my co-host, the original troubled man for troubled times and future mayor of New Orleans. Excuse me. Former future mayor of New Orleans, Mr. Manny Chevrolet. Welcome, Manny.
Hey, man. What is happening with you?
Oh, you know,
You're playing gigs.
Playing gigs. I'm
going to... and they're all... Everyone's so positive. Well, and they're great gigs.
Well,
standing room only.
Well, you know, I don't know.
Or sitting room only, because they can't stand up.
Well,
your crowd.
Yeah, some can sit, some can stand. Yeah, you know, it's a variety
of
all that.
What else is going on? Yeah.
Flying up to New York, or at least trying to fly up to New York on Friday to play Mercury Lounge. On Sunday.
The Mercury Lounge. Where is that?
That's on Bowery in Manhattan.
All right.
On Houston Street.
Houston. And, it'll always be Houston to me.
To you, okay. All
you
right.
know, when I lived in New York, I'd have arguments just like I have down here with these fucking idiots down here. You know, what is it? Burgundy.
Well,
it's Burgundy, you fucking idiots.
Well, that's not the worst of it. It's like we have melpomene, which is actually melpomene.
Yeah, or calliope or calliope.
Calliope. They say calliope instead of calliope.
What is the problem with
CL10.
This? Is another, this is like...
Instead of Cleo.
Reason number 855 why I hate people. People are the worst.
Oh, well, you know. What you
can't
gonna do?
Stand
what you, gonna, you can't get away from
it. Can't even pronounce a word right.
Oh, well, some can. Some can.
You know.
But, yeah, I'm going to try to fly through the airport shutdowns happening. Apparently, it's, gonna be,
it's all going to be good.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah,
because
everyone's getting $2,000.
$2,000. Oh, right.
Everyone's getting $2,000.
A tariff dividend.
So
I did see
you
that.
You can just tell someone to, you know, you can bump someone off with $2,000. Say, hey, let me get on this flight.
Well, you know. I mean, they just got $2,000 too. So, you know, it's going to just blow, $680 million just for fun. Oh, well. It's a small change, really. So yeah, I'm going to try to fly up there. Now today is Armistice Day. You're aware of that. They call it Veterans Day, but it started off as the end of World War One. It's the 11th,
the great one.
The big war. The big war.
The war to end all wars.
Right.
That didn't do anything, man.
The 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month.
Right.
And that is today.
And that's today.
Yes.
That's when rape became legal for one day.
Well, no.
Boys came home and just could rape.
That's a different movie.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, okay. I think so.
Is that with the zombies walking?
Maybe. I think, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, something like that. The Purge, I don't
know.
I'm
not a big history buff.
Sure. Well,
you know.
Nobody is these days. Few people know anything that happened before they were born, generally. And often they're sketchy about that
stuff,
too.
Well, I used to like European history.
Okay.
I hated early American history as a kid. Thought it was boring. Always liked the European history. But then people started saying, well, you should check out mythology and all that bullshit. And I was like, I could not stand that.
Oh, yeah, it seems kind of silly, huh?
And the Greeks and the Romans and the Plato and the platypus.
Zeus and
give me a break,
right?
Yeah,
well, yeah.
I don't like any of those kind of movies.
Yeah,
either.
Let's
keep it real.
The fantasy movies. Well, speaking of movies, I went and saw the first movie that I saw in a theater. I went to the Britannia Theater to see this new Guillermo del Toro production of Frankenstein.
Oh, it's Frankenstein.
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 Well, so we wanted, because we, you know, he's a great filmmaker, often very visual, you know. We thought, even though the thing was going to come out the next day on Netflix, I could see it for free, but we thought, well, let's go see this in the theater. Big screen, it's a 35 millimeter print. Now, I went with my
now,
good...
the Britannia's not that big a screen, though. Really, it's not.
Well, it's bigger than my TV, is my,
okay.
what I'm saying.
It was a piece of shit.
Nice well, I thought it was a very fairly plodding production. Yeah, I was kind of disappointed, frankly.
I'm not a big fan of his, to be honest with you. You know.
Yeah, I mean, they're usually visually kind of stunning.
What else has he done that I've hated?
Oh, What, he did something about South America? I don't know if our guest remembers.
I saw
any
this
of those.
Movie he did about carnies, I think.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that was on one of the streaming services.
And I couldn't stand that either.
I kind of enjoyed that. I know. Yeah. I remember talking
about
it.
There wasn't enough rape in that movie.
Well, okay, second time that's come up.
I was looking for rape.
Well, okay. Reaching our
I don't know.
Here.
Guillermo means William.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right.
William del Toro. Okay. Toro means, come on, bull. Come on. Toro. Uh-huh. You ever been to a bullfight?
I have not. Have you?
Oh, many bullfights.
Really?
Oh, yeah. My grandparents used to take us all the time.
In Mexico.
Uh-huh. Used to go and see those bulls get slaughtered. Huh. You just kept rooting for the bull.
Sure. How can you not?
You know. It's just like watching NASCAR. You just want an accident. I don't care who fucking wins this race.
But the bull never wins, right?
No. Not really. But the funniest thing was, like, the third time I went to a bullfight, you know, the poor bull just got slaughtered. And my grandfather came with a box full of, like, tacos and stuff. And they were really good. And I asked my grandfather, I said, what are these tacos? He says, that bull. You're hurting that one that just got slaughtered the round before.
Fresh.
Oh, yeah, good stuff.
Real fresh.
Nothing goes to waste.
Nothing goes to waste. Exactly, exactly. No, I've seen many bullfights. I saw a bullfight in Spain once.
Okay.
In fact, yeah. The pageantry is what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know,
a lot of people have
matador,
problems.
And I used to, like, dig those matador outfits.
Yeah.
You know, I thought
tight
that
pants.
Would be, the jacket especially, I thought that would be, like, a good look for, like, a crazy punk rock band.
Sure.
All dressed up in matadors and sing, like, you know.
Yeah, the bolero jackets.
Yeah, right. And just sing some crazy punk rock, you know. But the bullfights are good.
And
they still
hats
have them,
that
I
go
guess.
Side to side, right?
Those hats and their hips go side to side.
Oh,
too,
okay.
You know,
the high waters.
High waters, yeah, right. And stuff like that.
Stockings.
Anyway, yeah, bullfights are good.
They're good.
Yeah, I like them.
Yeah, I would go see a bullfight. Now, a lot of people are the people out with PETA. You know, these animal rights organizations. They're very against these bullfights.
Fuck them.
Okay.
They're right behind rape as far as popular events.
Yeah, yes.
No, PETA does good stuff, I guess. You know, okay. They protect. You know, I just can't stand those long commercials they have. You know, you ever watching like a show? Like, I watch like all the reruns of Law & Order. I just love the music.
Really?
The music is probably the only kind of music I like. The stories are okay, but then you get these commercial breaks for Law & Order on these channels. And it's all about, you know, this dog hasn't eaten in, you know, 74 days. Won't you do something to help this animal? And they're all actors. They're not really hungry, these dogs. It's all set up. It's all set up.
Staged.
And the
all
cats
dogs
are
actors.
Yeah. You know, they're just fucking.
But they say never work with dogs or animals or children because they'll always upstage you, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they're doing that in these commercials. And I used to have a good friend of mine who lived down here. He committed suicide about a year ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I met him. He was one of the first people I met down here who wasn't from down here. And I actually lived with him for a while, and we were drinking buddies and stuff. And he would just sit there. He couldn't sleep, the guy. He'd sit there all night. This is back in the early 2000s. And he'd just be on the phone, just watching these commercials, just giving these people his money.
Oh, jeez.
He did it constantly. Now, he could afford it. He could afford it because he made some good cake, you know. But it's like, you know, hey, man, go to sleep, man. You know, there's only so much you can give this dog.
This seems to go hand in hand. I knew a friend who got deep in the hole to Sister Cleo.
Oh.
And she could afford it, but it doesn't take away the sting of how much she sent to Sister Cleo.
Well, actually, I've known people, not just this friend of mine, but I've known people over the years that they had to have interventions for.
Yeah.
Because, listen.
The home shopping.
Home shopping.
Yeah. Right.
You know, Reverend somebody and that kind of thing.
Oh,
that.
That's the worst with the old people. And then once they get your number, man, they keep calling you up, especially with those the religious charities. They keep hitting you up over and over and over again.
Yeah, there was this one guy in L.A. who was famous on the public access channels in L.A. in the late 70s and early 80s. And he got people to give him, I don't know why these people gave, because he was basically preaching some form of Scientology. He wasn't, there was no word, or there was some weird bit about it.
Yeah.
And he'd have people eating out of the garbage cans and, you know, giving him their last nickel and stuff like that.
Wow. Power of persuasion.
He was a really, I forget his name, but he always had really good sound bites. Really good sound bites. Like, I remember one, I was watching it once, and he would say, he went on and on and on and on about something, and all of a sudden he just stopped and said, "Now that's prayer, damn it!"
Okay.
You know, things like that. And he had chalkboards. He had chalkboards behind him. God, if anyone can remember his name in L.A. or late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, messages.
Public, yeah, messages. God, he was hilarious to watch.
I remember a guy that was out there who, it was not the same person, but I saw like videos of him. I think it was like Dr. Rule or something. And he would, it was kind of a bit of a...
Did he have a white beard?
Intellectual. No, he had some kind of, I don't think it was white, but one bit I remember him talking about how to extract all the last bit of the toothpaste out of a toothpaste tube.
I can tell you how to do that. Yeah, how to do that.
Well, he's like referring to it as, it's trapped in its plastic prison, and he's there talking you through as he's cutting it open and scraping it out.
I had a roommate who was always so broke that he would like take the scissor and just cut the bottom of the tube and squeeze it all out and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, that's what he was doing.
And he
all
had
that.
Green teeth for some reason.
Huh.
I don't know.
Okay,
why.
Well,
it was crazy.
Should have sprung for a new tube of toothpaste, maybe.
Well,
right. Well,
he was always late on the rent.
Oh, that sucks, man. I have a tenant like that nowadays. Sometimes he'll be like, almost like past 2 months late.
And oh,
then,
wow.
Then he'll catch up.
I would kick that fucker out.
Yeah, well, I want to, but, you know, it's like...
But your wife's sleeping with him?
No, not anymore, but, you know, they might get started again.
So
no,
the
just
security
kidding.
Deposit
just kidding.
Has been
just,
spent.
Just joking. Oh. It's a problem, man. It's like every time it happens, like, now I have to deal with this. This is anxiety that I have to take on.
Yes.
Yeah, the answer is yes.
Yeah, unless you kick him out.
I mean, it's not fair. I mean, I would never do that to somebody. You know, it's like, he has parents. I am a parent. I have children of my own. If my children needed rent money, I would give it to them. But you are not my child. Anyway, moving on. Some sad news that I saw yesterday. Great actress Sally Kirkland passed away. See that?
She did?
Yeah.
I didn't see that.
Maybe it was just today, actually.
Sally, I didn't see that. I've been busy. I know Diane Ladd.
That was last week. We talked about that, yes.
Sally Kirkland. Sally, now, who was she again?
Well, she was in some movie, Anna, maybe, but she was in a million small things. And, you know, I think she graduated from the Actors Studio in New York, like in the early 60s. And was
to put a face to her
was
name.
was on Broadway a lot, but then also a lot of... like small TV roles over the years. You know, she'd pop up in this movie or that movie and go, "Who is that?" And somebody would go, "That's Sally Kirkland." Go, "Oh, right.
Huh.
Anyway, she was 81 years old.
Oh, well.
Apparently she was someone who was naked so much in off-Broadway shows that she became known for that. You know, she just didn't care. She'd take her clothes off for nothing.
She retired to Whore Island, right? Is that what she did?
I don't know. I think she wound up in hospice at the end. But,
really?
Yeah, I think...
Naked. Junkie, naked hospice.
I think she was clothed.
With an old man, like, pouring Pepsi on his cock, trying to get it hard.
Who knows, man?
I know guys who've done that before, man.
Interesting.
Whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes, sure, baby. Sure, you got sure, it, sure. man. Listen, never waste a boner.
Okay, I've heard that.
Never. At this age, never waste a boner.
Okay.
You know, and always don't always treat a fart as a fart either.
That's been said before on the podcast. Yeah. Not by me. Not something I would have said, but someone else said it and then asked me to take it out, as I recall. But early on, many, many years ago. Anything else, Manny?
Yes.
Okay.
Did you hear that our sheriff who lost the election, the incumbent sheriff.
Susan Hudson?
Yeah, she had to go in front of the board, Louisiana Board of Ethics.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, when you run for an office, you've got to do these reports. You've got to file these reports electronically, or you do them in person, or you can mail them if you have enough stamps. But apparently, she didn't fill out one of her forms. And, you know, this is someone who raises money. You know, I don't raise any money. You know, but she raises money, and you got to report all this stuff.
Right.
And she didn't. She forgot. She was late, apparently, and then she was going to be fined $5,000. And her excuse was, did you hear this?
No, no.
Her excuse was she went to the Board of Ethics in Baton Rouge, which I've gone there before.
I'll bet.
And she explained that it wasn't her fault. Her lawyer, who did all the filing for her, was in jail.
Oh, well, that explains it. Okay.
You know, and so she must have pled a really good story, a good argument, because it went from a $5,000 fine to a $500 fine.
All right.
So she got off pretty easy.
Yeah. It's a blessing.
I guess that's her last little freebie before she gets booted out, you know, in January when she has to give over the job to, what's that chick with the Jerry curls? I forget her name. Woodfork.
Yes.
Yeah.
Michelle Woodfork.
Not really Jerry curls.
No, she has more of a process, though.
Yeah, wax kind of thing. It's part of her skull, it looks like, her hair.
Yeah, she has straightened hair.
Yeah, it's something like that. I don't know how much that costs, but it kind of looks cool.
Yeah,
in
it looks
some
nice.
Ways.
She's you know,
maybe she could have it look like a badge.
Okay. interesting idea. Crest of some sort.
Yeah, and then also last thing, I don't know if you have any, but last thing, you know, you're going to travel, hopefully travel. Maybe you won't do this, I'm sure.
We'll see.
Some guy at our airport here in New Orleans, he went through TSA, and he decided, like, you know what? I'm going to get through this fast. So he took off all his clothes.
Oh, no.
Down to his chones. He took off all his clothes, and they just stared at him. And he was dancing around a little bit and stuff like that.
Really? He did a little dance,
like a little Irish jig.
Oh, no.
Like that.
No, that's no
and,
good.
But he was wearing boxers. And I saw the whole footage. It was very funny.
Huh.
And apparently, you know, he did this, but he didn't. They didn't detain him or anything. They just
let him go through?
Yeah, they just let him went through.
They put him in the front of the line?
Yeah, he was flying to Kuwait. You
okay,
know, so,
well, that should go over big there.
They just wanted to get him out because he flies to Kuwait.
So his stunt worked.
His stunt worked. Okay. Yeah, man. You got that right, man.
I'll keep that one in mind.
Everybody likes a good gag.
Anyway, so that happened. And, you know, I would just think it's a lot of trouble to go through.
Yeah.
Because then
you
got to put all the clothes back on.
Right, right.
Unless he walked to the plane and just joined us. I don't know.
Okay. All right, well, maybe we should get to our guest, huh? while you can still breathe. All right, we have a terrific guest tonight. He's been monitoring the show on and off over a period of time, and we recently kind of crossed paths, and I thought, oh, yeah, that guy would be perfect. So he's a two-time Grammy Award-winning recording engineer, music and video producer, and the owner of New Orleans audio-visual production facility, Sound from Space, right here in this neighborhood. He's engineered or produced sessions with all kinds of greats, Robert Plant, B.B. King, Herbie Hancock, Dr. John, Alan Toussaint, Fats Domino, Galactic Rebirth, on and on and on, The Meters, just to name a few. He's also a professor of music business at Tulane University and a member of the Memphis chapter of the Recording Academy. We're going to get into all that and much more, but without further ado, the great Mr. Chris Finney. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah. Glad to have you here, you know. I know we've worked together many times over the years, you know. But one time I always think, which I don't really remember, but I always see your name on the credits, which
we must have done that,
which is the second Geraniums record that we recorded at Truck Farm.
Mm-hmm. I was trying to think back of when you and I first crossed paths. And I may have met you
at
as
a gay
early
bar.
Who knows? We're so out of our minds.
Lesbian bar.
On poppers.
I love lipstick lesbians, man.
Sure. Yeah, what's
who
not
does?
To love?
Who doesn't?
Yeah, I know.
I like them all.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Especially the redheaded ones.
Okay.
Tall, redheaded lipstick.
Oh, you have someone in particular in mind?
Oh, many. Oh, I could tell you a few, but we don't have...
Yeah, we don't have that kind of time. Yeah. So, you were saying, Chris?
I think we first crossed paths in the Keith Keller days.
Oh, okay.
Because he was a bit of a mentor to me, and I got caught up in, you know, Mike Mayhew. I was in Mike Mayhew's circle for a while, and still am.
Right.
And Keith was a big influence on Mike, and kind of, you know, through that process, Keith had a lot of influence on me and did his Svengali mind tricks on numerous occasions.
Keith was quite a guy, man. Keith and I were real tight, man.
One of one.
He was a big man, wasn't he?
He was a big,
large.
He was a big guy.
Isn't that how he died?
Ultimately, yeah, contributed to his demise.
He was tall. He was, you know, just
snored to death.
Big in every way, you know. But he was light on his feet. That's what I always noticed about him.
Did he do a mama cast?
No,
I think he was asleep. I think he was asleep.
Just a power nap.
Sleeping in his chair.
The most powerful of power naps.
Right. Because
he was like 400 pounds or something, right?
He was over three.
Like Dick Gregory kind of guy, right? The jaws of life would come and take him out, right?
I don't know. He was a powerful man, for sure.
Yeah. He was. And he had one pair of cut-off sweatpants that he wore his entire life.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, sure.
But yeah, man, that place on Annunciation he had, incredible. That you know, big double parlor with all the plaster archwork and pendants and everything. That was about, I would say, maybe 60% renovated.
Yeah.
And then he just stopped.
He was a bit of a gentrifier before it was cool.
Oh man, he bought that place on Annunciation for I think $18,000. Now that's when you couldn't give a property on
totally.
In that block of Annunciation. Now that same place is probably worth $1 million or something.
Easily,
you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was definitely kind of a homesteader down there. Yeah, Keith, I remember
in the Garden District.
Yeah.
Stone's throw from the bridge.
Like, you know, I'd known Keith and I'd recorded with him. And then one time we did this deal and I worked like a really good deal on him. Like, and then the next day he called me up and he goes, man, that was I don't know how you did that to me. He goes, but we should be partners.
Nice.
So we did become quite close. We were studying neuro-linguistic programming together.
He got me into it as well.
Oh, no kidding.
I'm a fair student myself.
Oh, okay. Well, I've dropped off study, but I understand all the principles. It's it's a natural
thing. Just don't
get
caught using it.
Well, even right from the start, they teach you this has to be used ethically, or it will come back to bite you.
Use it for good and not evil.
Yeah. Of course.
Now, what is this?
Oh, it's just it's the use of language in persuasion. And it was developed by pimps use it for sure. No,
yeah.
Pimps are fucking, and that's how it was
like
developed.
Like Epstein is a pimp, right?
Sure. Well, that's how it was developed by like Erickson and Bandler and
Ritz Perls, yeah.
Right. And what
I don't know who any of those people
just
are.
Just different psychologists, theoreticians, linguists. And
like Dr. Lecter?
I don't
Dr.
know.
Dr. Lecter?
I think he was a psychiatrist, right?
Yeah.
Effective. They developed it by watching people who were good at persuasion and sort of quantifying what was going on and the different techniques that were being used and creating a matrix for that.
So basically, like pimps who are convincers, right?
They just convince
people to do stuff.
Yeah, well, that's what they say.
Just like Trump, our president. He's just convinced people.
In a weird, bastardized kind of way, yes.
He's
absolutely.
Just convinced the stupid, fucking minded people of this country, which is 99% of them, if
sure,
you ask me.
Myself included.
And, 99%
not
of this city.
Stupid minded.
You know, but who say Burgundy, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, you go to Metairie and they have Orion Street and Hesiod.
Right.
And they throw all that mythology you hate right out the window.
Right. I'm guessing that you are from New Orleans.
Born and raised.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what neighborhood did you grow up in?
So I was born in Mercy Hospital on Bayou St. John.
Nice.
And then as the Finneys proliferated, my folks moved us out to Metairie.
Okay.
And then ultimately River Ridge.
Oh, okay. Reefer Ridge.
Reefer Ridge, exactly. Yeah.
Sure.
Manny has relatives there in Reefer Ridge.
Yeah, my wife's from there.
Yeah, it's.
And how old are you?
Early 50s. What is this? 51.
Oh, okay. So you're just a kid.
On this show, you are.
Yeah, you're just a kid.
So,
because usually he books these guys who are dying, and then they die.
Well, a few have. Not every. Most have not. Most are still have survived the.
Not a few. A few means three. We've had more than three die on us.
It might be four or five.
We've got Uganda. We killed Uganda.
Oh, man. Yeah, we have
killed
Uganda.
That guy.
We have Mickey Sonsenbach. We lost. We have Stanley Atkins. We lost since then.
Oh, jeez.
Carlo Nuccio. Yeah,
a few others. I don't know. Let's back. Our guest. We have a live one on the right
for now.
Strike while the iron's hot. So tell us. You went to school there in Metairie, and
yeah, did the high school thing at Rummel.
What about elementary school?
St. Matthew out in River Ridge.
Okay, nice.
And, so it's hardcore Catholic stuff.
Oh yeah.
Now, were you ever raped?
Not
again, it keeps coming up. Jesus, nice. It's better to block it out.
I don't think I've been to a bullfight either.
It's better to block it out if you had been, really. That's what I think.
Well, you could use Renee's excuse. You can't keep a secret. You know,
Well, that's what I said. That's what kept me safe, is the priest could tell that I was the kind of kid that could not keep a secret.
Maybe that was my problem.
Had a big mouth.
I had a big mouth.
Yeah, right. You see, they know. It's like, oh, no. This kid is...
It exempted me from those activities.
Exactly. I really think it did, you know, if you're a mouthy kid who's...
Probably. I mean,
you know, like, oh no, I need somebody withdrawn. You know?
That's right. There's a certain profile you have to
fit. Right. Okay, so you were safe. Good.
Yep. As far made as it we through know. Unscathed. Actually, had a relatively positive experience through all of that. Minus the Rummel being all boys, that was a little
sure.
Weird.
It's tough, you know. My parents threatened to send me to Jesuit one time when I was, they didn't like what I was doing at Ben Franklin, and I said, hey, don't you have to take an entrance exam for that? And they said, yeah. And I said, let me take that test.
Yeah, right.
Watch how badly I do.
Exactly.
They thought, okay, well, let's not call his bluff here. So were you playing music at all at that time? Were you?
I guess you could say I was playing with music.
Okay.
I started playing, you know, guitar in a room full of 30 kids banging out a C chord badly in grade school.
Okay.
And I recognized there was some magic to that, but never could really get a handle on it. And then I guess around 13 or 14, there was a cute girl in piano class, and I said, Dad, I want to play piano. So they got me into piano class.
I thought you just said you went to a boys' school.
Well, that was before high school.
Oh, okay.
So eighth grade, seventh, eighth grade.
Oh, so you went to a mixed school for
previous
junior
to that.
High, for junior
yeah,
high.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And so that kind of, you know, set the tone for the rest of the story. It was like a half-assed... terrible pursuit of terrible musicianship in hopes that it would get the attention of girls.
Okay. And it probably worked, huh?
It had, you know, I had a good...
It had its moments.
Until the lipstick lesbians. Oh, no. I had a pretty good batting average, but, you know, until high school, until the all-boys school, and it squelched.
Then it really took off.
So the got into tech stuff in high school, doing theater and stuff like that. If you didn't make it on the stage, they would foist you in the booth. And that just kind of always spoke
stage
to me.
Stagecraft.
Right.
I love it. I did that in summer school, a summer camp that I went to. I thought that was so cool.
Yeah, it definitely was rewarding when you weren't, you know, doing all the other things. And my grandfather was an electrician. My other grandfather was a mechanic. So I guess blessed and cursed that whenever I asked a question, they would not just blow me off, they would explain it to me in gory detail.
Your grandfathers.
Both of my grandfathers had different skill sets that were pretty profound. And
but
they
never took you to the bullfights.
No.
They don't have them here anymore.
It's unfortunate.
They have the Angola Rodeo, right?
We went to the Angola Rodeo.
You did go there? Really? See, I've never been to that.
Equally as horrific.
Yeah, okay.
I bet. Yeah.
But you don't get tacos at the end of it. Lots of stuff goes to waste at Angola. But
lives, particularly.
Yeah, right. Amongst other things. But yeah, so it was like I had this interest in, you know, technology, I guess you could say. And then somewhere around senior year, our band had to record a demo. We had a garage band and, you know, we were recording a demo. And I kind of fell in love with the other side of the glass
mm-hmm.
right about then. And there was a studio in Metairie that mainly did heavy metal stuff and rock and roll. It was this place called Side One Studio.
Okay.
So I went to work for the guy who ran it, who was a Jesuit cohort with mm-hmm. Ben Mumphrey.
Oh, okay.
And I recorded Ben's band, and that's how he and I kind of fell into circles
right.
together.
Former guest, yep. a great engineer himself.
And a great influence on me, and a great friend. He's always, he's got a really good sense of integrity that has kind of always, you know, iron sharpens iron kind of thing.
Right,
know?
Right.
And I've always appreciated that about
I love that guy.
Him as an engineer and as a person.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so just kind of fell into that and attempted to go to college. Tulane wouldn't have me, nor could I have afforded it if they did. Loyola wouldn't have me, even though I was an altar boy.
Okay.
But then again, it's the Jesuits. And
right.
You
right.
got to be in that clique.
Yeah.
And so Loyola wouldn't have me. So I opted
Maybe
for...
Maybe you just weren't that smart.
Well, I don't
they
know.
They didn't accept you because you just weren't that
smart. Firm grasp of the obvious.
You've been very successful.
Your insight is profound.
Don't. It was like, oh, God, this guy,
don't,
no.
Don't sell yourself
short. There are bags of hammers
Chris,
more
no,
intellect.
No, I kid
no,
you.
No,
I don't know who you are, but I kid you.
I think it. No, I think it's... It, there's some truth
it was
to that
probably the best thing for you.
I was a solid C student.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I made the most of what
right
I
now,
could.
Yeah.
So I went to UNO and, you know, still...
Which is going
to
be LSUNO soon. Do you know
it's
that?
The LSU New Orleans.
Which yeah. it was before
it used
I was...
to be yeah, LSU.
They're
UNO,
taking yeah. over LSU.
LSU New Orleans.
Our Governor LSU. Landry.
We're back.
Yeah. He's taking it over.
Yeah.
Man.
Well, at the time, the director of the jazz studies program was Ellis Marcellus.
At UNO. Oh, yeah, yeah. No,
and
I was
a buddy of mine said, you know, they have this work study thing that you can go and get a job on campus and they'll pay for your school and you can pocket your student loan.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, this sounds like a good
an angle
racket.
Here,
you know?
Right?
Yeah.
Sounds like City Hall.
So maybe that's where we learned it. And so they know why the state's getting involved.
Right.
So, I went and applied, and they said, well, we have this job setting up the sound system on campus. I said, I'm 100% in. And so I started doing that regularly, and UNO had a bar on campus, and I would set up the sound system every Wednesday night for the jazz program, LS.
Yeah, what's that called? The sand?
The sandbar.
Sandbar, yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, it kind of shows you the trajectory you were on if you're at UNO, the bar on campus, literally across the street from the science building. And, open all day long, and there was no, right. you know, no one had any qualms about buying a beer and walking into class with
sure.
it.
Sure, well, it's New Orleans.
And yeah. yeah, and it was the 90s, you know. But I started doing sound, and I'd get, you know, I started falling into the circles with Ellis and, you know, Jim Singleton and all those, that whole crowd, Torkanowski and the jazzers of the
right.
day. And one day, Ellis busted me doing something untoward. May or may not have been herbal
okay.
remedies involved.
Sure.
And he kind of pulled me to the side and he said, look, what you fail to realize is that you are not good enough as a musician to pull this kind of stunt. And kind of broke my heart. It was like, wait a minute, dude.
But was he right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I was a cringeworthy bassist.
Okay.
You know, growing up in Metairie, it was all heavy metal. And so here I am trying to hold my own with these jazz guys.
Right.
And they're looking down at the R&B guys. And
right.
the R&B guys could smoke me. So it was just like I had no shot. And so he said, you know, what I suggest is your prowess with a microphone is on par with your colleagues and their instruments. So maybe that's a road you should pursue.
So, you know, Ellis was my teacher at Noka, man, and that sounds exactly like the kind of very penetrating and,
yeah, right.
and concise advice that he would give someone.
Yeah,
and
totally.
It could really change the trajectory of your life
100%
in five minutes.
Completely, because it was like he you know, he broke my heart and told me the truth, but at the same time, put me back together and ordained the rest of my career.
Right.
You know, and so I was
wow.
like, okay, well, I'm all in. Let's do it.
Nice.
So then I failed to mention at some point in there, I started hanging around John Otan's store, Rock and Roll Music. In Mid-City.
Yeah.
And
my former classmate at Loyola. We did get into Loyola, sorry.
Yeah,
but I left. I left before it was, I left after 2 years. So it's, you know.
Before it became a burden.
It didn't become a problem. Yeah.
So, But I was working with John, and I met a cast of characters at Rock and Roll. You know, Big Dave Jacob, who just passed, and Louis Ludwig, who became a real influence. Rosie Rosado and Clark Vreeland was in those circles in those days.
Clark Vreeland, yeah, yeah.
Clark,
man,
became a big influence on me as well, because he was one of the first people who I felt was like crazy talented and powerful and older who took a young person seriously. He didn't make me feel like I was a 19-year-old or an 18-year-old. He made me feel like I was just a dude in it with him. And Louis did too. And so they had a, you know, little Rabidash studio in the back for John's record label.
Right.
And that's where I cut my teeth, learning how to do that stuff. And then one of the people who would come in all the time was John Thomas Griffith, who lived around the corner from the record store.
Yeah, who's from the Red Rockers.
He's a guitar player from the Red Rockers. And guitar player and lead
front
singer.
Man is from the Red Rockers, but then he started Cowboy Mouth with Fred. And,
with Fred, and back
Paul.
Then, Paul Sanchez. And,
right.
And early on, it was Paul Clement on bass.
Paul Clement,
and
yeah.
And then
yeah.
Steve Walters and shortly
the
afterwards.
The great Steve Walters from the Normals.
Living legend.
Yes,
and
love that guy.
Truly one of my favorite people on the planet. And
he's so rocking,
dude, like just legitimate, you know. And probably the most authentic person I know, short of like, you know, Napolitano or something, you know. It's just like balls to bones, you are that thing, and that's it.
I have a great Steve Walters story that somebody from that circle told me. That it's when after Paul Clement left or was leaving Cowboy Mouth, and they kind of pulled Steve Walters out of retirement,
right?
And and they went to his house or something, or he came to them and to have the first rehearsal, and he pulls his bass out, and the bass is totally covered, the strings are all covered in rust, and it's all filthy, you know, and they're kind of laughing at it. He goes, "You think that's funny? Wait till you hear me play."
this is a perfect analogy.
Right, right.
Yeah, no, he's still one of my favorite people. And so right around the end of my first semester, after Ellis had kind of shattered me and put me back together, the guys from Cowboy Mouth asked me to go do guitar tech stuff. And Mike Mayhew was doing front of house for them.
Okay.
Mike had to dip out to go have heart surgery right about that same time. And so the guys came to me and said, "Hey, are you going to go back to college or what? Because we need a sound man. Will you come on the road with us?"
Oh, right.
And in that moment, I was like, "Fucking right, let's go. I'm going on the road with
I'm joining
and
the circus."
I joined the circus. My folks were none too pleased to hear about it. But, you know, to their credit, they went with it. And, you know, I realize now the mechanism that triggered. Now that I'm a dad, I get it. Most of your life is propping up your kids, bailing them out, and just standing back and hoping for the best.
Trying to give them the best chance.
That's right.
Right.
And you know, you try not to damage them too much. And I think that's more of what my folks were doing, is like, you know, we could freak out, but we're just going to see where this thing goes. And so I went on the road with the band, and that was really the... you know, the pebbles that precluded the avalanche of how I ended up being, you know, long, boring story. I fell in love with being in the studio more than being on the road.
Interesting how the happenstance of life winds up being the actual, you know, the fulcrum that it all turns on.
It's kind of true. In a moment, literally a moment, I decided, I'm going on the road with you guys. And
so you guys were playing so many, like 250 gates
close.
A year,
I think,
or something?
185 is the number that comes to mind at that time. But yeah, it was, and the band went to Europe, and I had joined just before I could have gotten in on that. So I had to sit at home while they went to Europe and had all these amazing ventures and came back. And then we toured the country in a converted airport shuttle.
And you're just mixing front of house?
Mixing front of house, setting up the stage, teching their guitars.
Right.
And just getting to be pals and having adventures and learning from these cats who were, you know, older than me. And
getting a ton of experience, a ton of reps.
Experience and meeting people all over the place. And, you know, the big thing for me was I got to put a microphone on a snare drum on a great drummer every night.
Yeah.
And that's the skill ultimately that you need to develop to be a recording engineer or, you know, or any kind of engineer or producer, is you have to do it over and over again. You have to experiment and make mistakes.
Who's this drummer?
Fred LeBlanc.
Okay. I don't know who that is.
He's a force of nature.
Oh, okay.
He certainly was back then.
Yeah. You know, Fred's one of the greats.
And
this comes out of the Chris Luckett tradition. You know, there's a line, Chris Luckett, Fred LeBlanc, Kyle Molaison.
Kyle,
like,
yep.
Guys that are beasts behind the kit like that.
Yeah, and I was a Dash Riprock fan too. So that seeing Fred and that, you know, and then kind of maturing into Cowboy Mouth was a little more developed than Dash. Dash was really raw and kind of primal, and Cowboy Mouth had harmonies and they had a deeper songbook. And I saw that as, you know, I love the diversification of the band, how each member of the band had enough autonomy that when they came together, it really was
okay.
It was something special.
Right on.
And so I enjoyed that for a while, and then they opened House of Blues, and Chopper Brady, Mike was going to work at House of Blues. He's like, I'm not coming back on the road. And Chopper called me and said, hey, do you want to come off the road? You can make the same, if not more money, and you can sleep in your bed every night. It was like, yes, 100%.
So as opposed to someone else's.
Okada, I can tell you some stories. I have a Steve Walters story, as a matter of fact.
Tell it.
Oh, I don't. I would have to clear that with Steve first.
All right.
It's a good one. And so,
don't bring it up then if you're not going to tell it.
Use your imagination.
It's a good one.
You
said it's a good one.
Well,
say it.
Theater of the mind. You can just imagine how good it could be to you. You know, it's leaves.
Well, I don't even know.
I can tell it, but you'd have to cut it out.
Yeah, that's all right.
Don't cut it out anyway.
I know how valuable editing time is.
Not if he says it. Not if he doesn't say it.
Or if we have to get permission from Steve first.
Sure. Yeah. Anyway,
so, it was like, you know, this opportunity to stay home, and then I realized I wanted to have a studio. I was working at that place out in Metairie, working with different bands, doing a lot of rap and gospel. You know, Greg, the owner, would throw us on the sessions that he didn't want to do. And so at some point I realized, you know, there's 1,000 things under $1 in Greg's studio that we could make better, that a studio would be better than $1,000 better if we fixed all those things.
Yeah.
And so me and my buddy George Ortolano got together, and his grandfather had invented the snowball machine, the snow wizard.
Oh,
and he had the
wow.
building where the snowball machine was invented on Magazine Street. It's now the Pack and Ship and a framing place.
Oh, okay.
And it was sitting empty. And his grandma offered it to us and said, if y'all want to do something, because she recognized the value of having somebody in there more than rent, if it's sitting empty.
Okay.
So she let us build a studio in there.
Nice.
And we pooled together our resources, and we built the studio, Magazine Sound Recording. And Ben kind of joined us and cut our teeth. Napolitano, Mike Napolitano, would come and do some stuff there. We did some things, you know. We Afghan Wigs and Squirrel Nut Zippers. There were some things that
right,
came through
there.
Mainly as a byproduct of Napolitano. But it was, you know, at the time, it was Kingsway and Egyptian Room and a couple of smaller places. And we had a shot at edging out, you know, of getting into the brass ring. And so we went as hard as we could, and we just didn't know what we were doing as far as running a business.
But you're getting, again, tons of recording experience.
Analog tape, so it was, you know.
Yeah, I want to talk about that too, because you've seen, just as I've seen, you know, the evolution or de-evolution of the music business, the business side. You've seen the evolution of analog to digital, and everything, all the good and the bad that comes from that. But right now, it's about that time, Manny.
Yeah, we're gonna take a break. We'll be right back.
Awesome. Talk.
We'll be right back.
And we're back. Back with Mr. Manny Chevrolet. I am Renee Coleman. Back with our guest, Mr. Chris Finney. Now, Chris, I know you're somewhat familiar with this podcast and the fact that we are a listener-supported operation. We have Venmo and PayPal links that our beloved listeners will access to buy us cocktails, help support our, defray our operating costs. And a guy I mentioned a few weeks ago is having latched on to one of my catchphrases from the show, has supported this week's cocktails. My old buddy from the Governor's Program in Lake Charles, David Monette. Shout out to David Monette, who used the PayPal link to buy tonight's cocktails. And as I say, those links are in the show notes of every show, as well as the Facebook page. And also in the show notes, we have the Patreon link there. We have a handful of patrons supporting us week in and week out. Thank you so much. We love you. Also, the link for the Troubled Men podcast t-shirts is right there. And I always say, follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it. Give us 5 stars. Helps us a lot. Cost you nothing. That's the phrase he had latched onto. He uses it with his coworkers. Everybody can try that. See how that lands. Let's see what else. I have some dates coming up here on Friday, November 21st. I'll be playing with the Tremolo Kings at DBA. Then I have that next Sunday, November 23rd, with Susan Cowsill at the Wild Things Weekend in Hammond. And, of course, always, every Sunday now, the Iguanas at the Carousel Bar, 7 to 10. All right, back to our guest, Mr. Chris Finney. Now, so, Chris, you're talking about how you're cutting your teeth, doing all these recordings. You're working at the House of Blues as well, mixing a ton of great acts. And
yeah, mainly getting the thing I took away from House of Blues was being proximal to such incredible musicianship and seeing what that level of performance feels like. You know, it's one thing to listen to a Neville Brothers record. It's another thing to see the Neville Brothers live. It's yet another thing to stand on stage with the Neville Brothers and
right.
the Allman Brothers or Nine Inch Nails or Johnny Cash or Sonny Rollins.
Right.
All these, it's insane the list of people. Johnny Guitar Watson.
Amazing, man.
You know?
Yes.
Or, so great. You know, in the weirdest part of the universe, I was assigned to walk Charles Brown out on stage because he was blind. The band would fire up, do a couple of songs to warm up, and then when they would announce him, I had to escort him out to the stage, and then I would dip behind the monitor board. So we'd be sitting behind the wall off the wings, and we'd be chit-chatting. And over the 3 or 4 times, we kind of made a friendship, like a pal, at least.
Right.
And I felt comfortable enough asking him about things and, you know, talk to him about my favorite recording of all time, on the short list at least, is Bring It On Home to Me by Sam Cooke.
Yeah.
He told me, oh, that's Lou Rawls singing the harmony, the second vocal. Yeah. Something you couldn't have known before the internet unless you spoke to someone who was on the session, uh-huh. you know? And he's telling me about writing that song, and he's talking about working with Sam Cooke and getting all this great insight. He reaches into his coat pocket, and he pulls out a flask and has a nip of whiskey and offers it to me, and I'm like, this is up there with smoking a joint with Bob Dylan or something. Like, I'm taking a nip of whiskey with Charles Brown. Like, this is unbelievable. Walk him out on stage, do the show. So it was just story like that over and over again. You know, smoking a joint with Jam Master Jay from Run DMC. Like, that was one of my all-time heroes.
Okay.
You know, those kinds of things.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's what an incredible opportunity.
How else would you have access? How else would a kid in my position have access to that kind of stuff? And then being able to soak up those performances and seeing what the mechanics of a performance like that looks like.
Right.
And realizing that these weren't like moments that just happened. These cats were like Olympians who had trained and trained and trained, and they weren't waiting for lightning to strike. They could get out there and do it at any given moment.
Right.
And so that was something I tried to bring back into the studio as much as possible.
Well, you know, we were talking about the advent of going from analog recording to digital recording. You know, I came up in the era when we were using, you know, tape. Everything was on tape. That's all the only way there was to do it.
Totally.
And 16 track or 24 track, and you've used all the tracks, and now you need to fix a thing. And you just have to stand up there and be an adult in front of the microphone, or, you know, and be able to deliver it. Like,
it's true.
And as an engineer on your side, like, you guys are doing in that era, as far as punch-ins, punch-outs, you know, like, you're doing destructive editing.
You learn grace in that moment, because everybody has one. You know, there's the great Dan Prothero told me one time, every engineer has one inadvertent sacrifice they've made to the recording gods. And there's like the lost album or the lost take, or, you know, you accidentally punched in a measure too soon on George Porter Jr.
Right.
And his grace was just like, oh, it's no problem, I'll do it again.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, thank God, because that could have been a career ender.
Well, and that people that grew up playing in that era of recording,
they were complicit,
had the ability to do that.
Yeah.
And really, anyone who is competent at playing live in a consistent at a high level should still be able to do that. You know, you can walk out on the floor and do it at will. Like, and it's funny, I'm sure you've seen or been experienced, like, someone doing a Pro Tools edit that takes 45 minutes when the person could walk out on the floor and have it done in 5 minutes.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I did the first session that Dr. John ever did on Pro Tools.
Yeah.
And I saw him go through that exact evolution where he was like, you know, he was doing a Rhodes overdub, and he made a mistake. And he came back in, and he was listening, and he points out the mistake. And I said, oh, wait, I can fix that. And psh, 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 I did it super quick. And he was like, oh. And then the next take or so, he you know, before he comes back in the room, he says, do I got to do that again, or can you just fix it with the computer machine?
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, you're of all people. No, I'm going to punch you in. Like, forget I showed you that.
Right.
This is, you know. And he was always good about, you know, not relying on the technology and keeping his musicianship sharp, you know.
If you have the ability to do that, obviously it's faster and, you know, retains the integrity of the performance.
Totally. Totally.
Well, so take us in the timeline. So you're working at House of Blues, and you're working at this studio and magazine that you have.
I was funding the studio and magazine with the money from House of Blues.
Okay.
Almost purely.
Well, as they say, the way to make a small fortune in the recording business is start with a large fortune.
Yes. Yeah, that was pretty much it. And, you know, like I said, we weren't savvy business people, so it was kind of destined to fail. And then about 10 years into it, I felt like I should have had more to show for my career and just didn't quite understand what wasn't connecting. So I walked away for a little while, and I saw the writing on the wall that computers were coming. I knew it was coming. This was like 2000, 2001. You could start buying a Pro Tools system and a computer for about the same cost as making a real record.
Right.
The difference was, if you spent that money with us in the studio, you'd have a record in 3 to 6 weeks. If you spent that money on a Pro Tools rig, it might have been a year or 18 months before you had a record. You had to learn how to use it. You had to, you know,
sure,
accrue all the other accoutrements that go into it. And, you know.
And as a musician, do you want to become an engineer and then, you know, still try to be a musician?
Exactly.
Or is it better, like, you know, the Western civilization has succeeded largely because of specialization. You know, we all do one thing really well, and then we all get together and share those.
I was like Robert Heinlein's take on that, though. Specialization is for insects. Wow. Should be able to change a tire and a baby's diaper.
Well, I can do both of those.
Exactly.
But anyway.
And even an adult diaper.
Sure. Well, I'm going to
eventually.
I'm going to have to.
Unless you go now.
Unless you go to the naked old folks home.
Oh, geez. No, you don't want to see that. That's nothing. Nowhere I want to be.
It's Sally Kirkland.
Yeah.
And the guy from the airport.
It's the guy. Exactly.
So you land in another recording situation. Take us to the next step.
I dipped out to go work at a computer store, and this is pre-Apple stores. And this was a small computer store in Metairie that specialized in Apple computers.
Okay.
And it was cool because I was already into Apple computers, and I recognize that that was the tool for creative people. Mm-hmm. PCs were for business people, and you know, Apples were for creative people. So I figured learning how to work the inner workings of an Apple wouldn't be a bad thing.
Okay.
And in the meantime, it was a paycheck. And I had a little tiny studio in a shack in Metairie, in Fat City, and a little one-room spot. But it was enough, and I could keep practicing my Pro Tools, keep putting microphones on things, and making a living from this. And it was kind of a... I kind of missed that existence. It was very simple, you know?
Yeah,
and,
monk-like.
It was. But eventually... people started coming into the computer store from the music industry to get their computer fixed. Reggie brought Alan Toussaint in.
Oh, okay.
And it was, hey, we got a computer and we need somebody to come help us fix it. And I'd go out there and help him set it up. And then George Porter Jr. Was messing with a computer, and you know, Dave Stocker called me in to come help him do that. And then Terrence Blanchard and Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor. And so it's like all these folks are now I'm right back in the recording world.
Right.
It was like I was trying to quit.
Keep trying to get out, and they keep pulling you back in. So were you involved in working on the Nine Inch Nails at Trent's studio there on Magazine Street?
I helped out a couple times. I worked, Mike Montero dragged me along for a few of those, because same lesson I was getting from the computer store, which is that you can have this talent, and the people, the music, the folks in the industry can know that you have this talent, but unless you have the business infrastructure put around you, you could be wasting your time and leaving money on the table. I'm watching this guy at the computer store charge hundreds of dollars an hour for me, and he's paying me $20 an hour. But it was consistent. I got a paycheck, and you know, whatever. And it was like, okay, lesson learned. Same thing with Montero. He's billing out MR Montero, Meters Running Montero. He was billing us at the top dollar, but he's bringing me in to fix the computer, and you know, he's paying me well, but it wasn't nearly what he was billing.
Right.
And so I realized, okay, if I'm going to make it doing what I do, I have to figure out this business part of things.
Okay.
And I'm still figuring it out. Like, I'm still, you know, 30 years later.
Well, when
I'm
you do,
still,
let me know.
Yeah, right. But, I mean, that's ultimately what led to, you know, teaching a class for the Tipitinas Foundation to high school kids. And it was, you know, Trombone Shorty, John Batiste, Chris Royal. Those guys are all my students. And hopefully something got through, because they all have careers now.
Yeah.
You know, they're all doing okay. And then one thing led to another, and Tipitinas Foundation became Trombone Shorty Foundation, and then that led to Tulane. And so that's always been a part of my own path of learning, is helping other folks learn it as best I can.
Nice, you know? Nice. But somewhere in here you record Fats Domino and Robert Plant, and what studio were you working
at? So that was at the Music Shed. That was all, so somewhere in the computer shop days, 2002, 2003, folks at Tips had gotten their hands on a Pro Tools rig, and they recorded a bunch of Rebirth Brass Band shows in the hopes of making a Rebirth Brass Band documentary or live performance, like to celebrate their anniversary.
I think we just had a guest on who was the video producer on that, Charlie Brown.
That's actually how Charlie and I connected.
Okay.
I did the audio for
He was the last guest. He was the last episode that came out.
What a great guy Charlie is, man. What a mind on that guy. Go listen to that episode. Oh, yeah.
See, this is how it works in on the Troubleman podcast and in New Orleans.
It's true. It's the biggest small town you've ever been to. If you haven't worked with somebody, you will.
Yeah. You know, there's a joke about there's really only one band in New Orleans and everybody's in it.
Yeah, right.
So
after right around Katrina, there was a group of guys who I had known forever had built a rehearsal room in this giant warehouse.
Right
up the street from Keller's old place.
Yeah, no, I know. I recorded there a bunch of times. Did a Lynn record, Lynn Drury record there.
Oh, right,
and,
right.
And Bruce Burrell had a... mastering studio there. Maybe still does.
No, I think he's at Misha's now.
Okay,
he's in the basement of Misha's.
That makes sense. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, so they had called me in to help with some acoustics in the rehearsal rooms. They were having trouble with bleed, and just the sound of the rooms wasn't great. And Eric Fletrich had started to build a little studio in the front,
which is Terry Fletrich's son from the Midday Show on Channel 4. Anyway,
I don't think I made that connection. Yeah, I knew he was related to the dentist on in Mid City, but that's all I knew.
Anyway, because the first time I met her, I was like, "Are you related to Terry Fletcher?" She goes, "Yes."
Eric's a great guy. And
he's a great guy.
A fantastic engineer.
Yes. Worked at the Egyptian Room.
He worked at the Egyptian Room. American
did
sector.
A record there with him. Yeah, yeah.
And he evacuated to Memphis for Katrina and never came home.
Mm.
So it left this kind of vacuum at the Music Shed, and a lot of people were asking about using the recording studio, but Eric wasn't around. So I kind of originally I went into it thinking, I'll build up the studio for when Eric comes back home.
Okay.
The studio will be up and running. And then Eric never came back home, and I found myself with a recording studio.
So you were angry?
Nah.
No?
You were inspired.
Did this all for him, and then he never came back.
That son of a bitch.
Exactly.
Mother. Left you high.
Right. I'm going to have words with him. Let me call him right now. Yeah,
call him right now, man. Put him on the show.
You know, I never thought about that. Let me explore these feelings. This
exactly.
Might be
no, you see, you got to skate over that, man. It's like everybody wants to be so aggrieved these days, you know?
I think all my grievances with Hurricane Katrina, and really, that's all
even
my scars.
You can't blame the weather. You know, the government is different.
You could try. What if the government was controlling the weather?
There you go.
The Jews aren't controlling the weather either. Please.
I thought it was the Yakuza, but
okay. Well, I can't say they're not. I don't know enough about the Yakuza to definitively take a position.
That was going around for a while that the Yakuza caused Hurricane Katrina in retaliation for World War II.
I don't know. People say crazy things. I saw a thing that you had on somewhere, and you characterized yourself as 14-time Grammy nominee, 12-time Grammy loser.
I
thought, I like that. That's someone.
But
that,
you won twice?
I have.
He won twice.
All right,
well,
that's good.
No, that's great. It's fucking great. But I just love the way you put it all in perspective.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of is, you know, I don't know if those numbers are entirely accurate, but the picture is
close
painted
enough.
There.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
You just get into a mode and you're just doing so much stuff that you never look up. And at some point, they say, hey, you know, John Fole came to me and said, hey, you heard we're nominated for a Grammy for that Dr. John record. I was like, what? Are you sure? He's like, yeah. And then the next thing you know, it was, hey, you know, fill out this form. They're going to send you a statue. I was like, holy shit, really? And you know,
but you don't get to go to the show.
Yeah, I've been to the show a couple times.
Yeah.
There's two... I know.
There's two shows.
There's two shows.
There's
and
the
daytime show.
I fell for the daytime one once.
Yeah.
I'm good. I love my Grammy folks, but yeah, if you're going to endeavor the daytime Grammy awards, eat first. Bring food in your pockets.
Oh, really?
Sneak in
some
whatever
nut bars or something.
Daytime Grammy libation. Is that like the soap opera
right,
and stuff like that?
The daytime
like
Emmys,
Bold and the Beautiful and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's the one with all the stuff they don't show on TV.
That's it. Yeah. But you know the technical stuff and it's fun. It's still a you know.
Sure.
Is that the Dorothy Chandler? Right.
It's.
Or
the Staples Center.
Mm-mm. Or the Staples Center.
Staples Center. Yeah.
Really? They have it at the Staples Center for the guys who don't get on TV?
Yeah. And it is...
Really?
It's 8 to 10 hours. They don't tell you when you're going to win your award. You can't leave.
But you know you're a winner.
No. You're nominee.
You
and you find out you that
but
you're
I
going there
they,
to find
you
out.
You just said they send you a form to fill
that
out.
That was after the award ceremony.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, because they have to FedEx it. And they want to
now,
know
do you keep your
there.
Grammy above your toilet?
So I've done both.
Yes.
If it's a band that I know would be impressed and influenced by it, if I know I can inspire them to a better performance, I'll put it out where you see it. But if it's a band that I know isn't going to value it for anything, I'll put it on the back of the toilet.
Now, what's that band?
I like a punk rock band or, you know, any number of bands that... carry spite for such honors.
Sure.
You know, the good ones.
Yeah.
Okay. The fun
well,
bands
you,
to work
you don't
with.
Want to name them?
I can't think of
yeah,
off the top of my head.
If you start like, trying to make lists of people, it's impossible.
It's a big black hole in the center of my skull.
Well, it's like, I like when somebody walked, so one time this girl walked up in the middle of one of these podcasts and she goes, hey, asking me and who are your favorite keyboard players to work with and I was like I can't start this list because I'm going to dig myself a hole
totally.
I'm going to hurt somebody's feelings
well then you get home and it's like at 2 a.m. you wake up and you go shit I didn't say
Yeah, yeah, no, you can't do that. Yeah, yeah, no, no.
Yeah, no, it's
like you said, you're just trying to do work. Just
yeah, and you're in a zone. You're not, that's the whole thing with like
celebrity.
But I
mean, you've worked with a million bands, and you've engineered and produced, and now there's got to be one band that you'd be like, fuck, why did I get myself into this shit?
One?
Yeah, a bunch.
Dozens.
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, what are those? Who are those guys?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they would be stoked to hear that.
Right, right. No one listens to this show, so don't worry, man. No one listens to this fucking show.
I'll say Davis Rogan.
Yeah, okay. Davis Rogan.
All right, all right. Yeah. Manny will accept a mention under those circumstances.
Yeah, the band would cash their paychecks at a place called One Stop. And the producer came to me and he said, well, what is this One Stop where the band cashes all their checks? The record company wants to know, is this a fraud thing? And I was like, well, One Stop is a check cashing place, but One Stop is also a dude who sells drugs in front of the One Stop. And so he realized that this was going to work against the ability to make the record. And so he bought drugs and he would hand it out as a reward.
Oh,
okay. For the performance.
Because they always say, you know, it's okay if it's a reward, but you can't be a lifestyle.
It was a lifestyle.
Well, yeah, so that's you want to stay away from it being a lifestyle. So you're there at the
music shed.
At
yeah.
The music shed that yep. that you're recording all yep. Dr.
Doing
John
all, that
all
stuff.
Those records.
Dr. John, so I had connected with Dr. John through Herman Ernest. And Herman was the house drummer for the House of Blues All-Stars.
Right.
And so Herman and I had built a really profound friendship. And
what a guy.
He's still one of the people I miss the most. I love everybody, but I'd trade any one of you motherfuckers for Herman in a
sure,
second.
Sure, yeah, yeah. It'd be a... Yeah, yeah.
It's a fair trade.
Herman, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so he was kind of grooming me and Mike Mayhew to work with Dr. John. And then Katrina happened, and Mike went to Nashville. And so I was just kind of last man standing, and I had the studio at the same time.
Again, proximity, happenstance, man.
Right place, right time, but yep. Chance favors the prepared mind, so it's
yes,
a little bit of
you
both,
go.
You know?
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
And so so Mac started needing more and more work. Herman would direct him my way, and I kind of got integrated into the band in that regard.
Nice.
David Berard and John Fole.
Nice.
And then Mac. And then it came time. We did shit tons of little one-offs. We did a tribute to Harumi Hosono, which he let me produce. Like, that was my first time driving a Cadillac, mm-hmm. you know? And that was a really fun thing. We did shit tons of things like that. And then the album came, and we went out to Dockside, and we posted up at Dockside for 10 days, made the record. And the first record, my buddy Jeff Jones, the Jedi Master, mixed it in New York.
Okay.
And Jedi and Mac were in a 12-step program together, so they were super tight friends in New York, and I really feel like it was everybody putting in their best effort as a collaborative group that got us the Grammy that first time.
Now, being at Dockside, it's crazy, man. For years, I would hear people talk about, oh, Dockside, it's so great, you're out in the country, and I'm like, I hate it already. I don't like the country. I don't want to be out there by myself.
That's a pretty special place.
Now, I finally recorded there a couple of years ago for the first time, went out and did a Loose Cattle record with Justin Tockett engineering, and John Aniello was producing and engineering from Record Plant. He's worked with everybody. Justin was sitting on the sofa like as the microphone concierge, you know. John would turn around and go, what do we have to record a snare or, you know, whatever, an accordion with? And you go, well, I have this. And you go, what do you like? And you go, well, I think this one sounds great. He's gonna go put that on there.
Yeah.
But
it's like using John McEnroe as a ball boy.
Right, right, right. But amazing. The fucking desk sounds so incredible, man. The thing that I love, and you know, the last few years I've, you know, worked in recording studios, my new thing is I don't go and set my amp. I don't try to get like a live sound. I just tell the house engineer, just give me a lead. Just give me the wire. I'll plug it in. If I don't like it, I'll tell you afterwards.
Yeah, we'll
you
start
know?
There. Yeah.
And you know, we did a couple of takes, and I'm like, let's go in and hear what this sounds like just to calibrate. And we walk into the control room, we're listening back to playback, and we're like, holy shit. That sounds fucking amazing.
It sounds like a finished record.
Yes,
like, you're just,
I know.
Like, holy shit. Yeah, it's remarkable. And I was thinking about that when you were saying that. There were three Collins tube compressors around from Keith Keller's studio.
I have one of them.
You have one of them. I have one of them. And Mike Mayhew had one that got lost in Katrina. So Keith's three compressors are down to two, and it's just me and you, bro.
So that one that's sitting at your new studio that I saw a couple of weeks ago, when I saw that, I walked in, and you know, you couldn't be there, but I was like, wow, Collins limiter. I was like, yeah, you know, I have one of those from Keith Keller, and Mike Mayhew said, I think that was from Keith.
That was it. Yep.
Those things sound amazing. You know, I went into Richard Gray's national TV shop on Jefferson Highway,
mm-hmm.
Maybe 15 years ago or something. I went with a friend. He was doing a tube repair on a stereo amp for, and I said, hey, you know, I have this weird thing. I don't know if you've ever seen one of these, a Collins limiter. And he goes, Collins limiter? That's what we used in Nam, man.
Holy shit.
He goes, those things are built like a tank.
They are.
I said, yeah, they are. He goes, yeah, man. You know, that's what I did in Vietnam as I set up a broadcast towers.
Oh, he was good morning Vietnam.
But he was in the truck. He said the VC would blow up the towers, but they wouldn't blow up the truck. So it was cool, man. I was safe. I was like, okay, well, can I bring it in for you? He goes, oh, yeah, no, I'd love to see it.
Yeah, that's
he
awesome.
He totally rewired the whole thing, recapped it and everything.
Yeah, I wish that guy was still around. I had a Dynaco that he could...
He still goes in there. He just doesn't answer the phone. You know?
Nice.
So he's still going in. Like it's like Sanford and Son in there. He's got a million TVs that don't work. Anyway, so back to your story. You're there. You're recording. So somehow you record 14 or 12 or some double digit
some
number of Grammy nominated records.
Yeah, between that and I was doing a lot of stuff with Tracy Freeman. I kind of became Tracy Freeman's right hand man.
Okay.
And Tracy was responsible for a lot of New Orleans records, mainly by virtue of the fact that he's been Harry Connick Jr.'s producer from day one. And, you know, that's kind of the bright light that leads the way for a lot of New Orleans musicians, because Harry is this great mashup of great guy, great success, and tremendous talent. And so he kind of
you
became...
Think so?
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. I'll stand
the
by that.
Worst.
I like talking shit about anybody,
yeah,
anywhere, anytime.
Like Aaron Neville has got to be the
fucking
worst.
That guy.
He sucks.
I mean... Probably to be business partners
I can't stand
with.
That voice.
But
yeah.
That's
everyone
good,
loves huh? that voice.
It's so silky, man. That's not to like about it. I don't know. No accounting for taste. That's what we
right.
always have
sounds
to say.
Sounds like fucking,
all right, well,
you know,
not everybody has to like
chocolate.
Everything.
What do they say? New Yorkers think mayonnaise is too spicy. So,
well, we're kind of winding our way down on the podcast, so we should talk about your new venture, your
sure.
latest venture, Sound from Space. It's a full audio visual production facility there. You have a studio. It's it seems like you're trying to marry the vintage analog hardware with the cutting edge digital technology, and you're also doing as well as audio recordings. You have a podcast and a video aspect. So talk about that.
Yeah,
a little bit.
I feel like it's diversification these days of kind of requires you to be good at a lot of things. We don't get the luxury of being specialists anymore. But if your effort is to facilitate people making great recordings, whether it's audio or video, I feel like you kind of have a duty to offer the full suite of tools. And nowadays, you know, I think New Orleans musicians have always, it's always been a meritocracy, and you always could rely on letting the music and letting your work speak for itself. And nowadays, you have to represent yourself on the internet one way or another, visually or, you know, whatever, social media. And so many folks now, when they want to come in to record, they want a video component that goes with it, or at least
okay.
some documentation of it visually.
Right.
And, you know, during the pandemic, I helped a lot of musicians make the transition from live performance to live streaming.
Right.
Because they...
And then porno.
Yeah.
Well, that's...
Because it's all about the porno these days.
It's all free, though. You can't make it... So you can't monetize any of this stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. OnlyFans is pretty lucrative.
Yeah, it is a big thing.
It hasn't been for me, but I...
Maybe you're not reaching the right audience.
I guess I'm not.
You need the naked old folks home.
Okay. Well, maybe I can come over for a consultation. You're right around the corner from my house.
I got a guy.
You're literally a block away from me.
Yeah. So that's, you know, the idea was that, you know, I knew I couldn't do something without a recording studio. I had all this gear piled up and, you know, this body of knowledge. And that's just, there's some things you are and there's some things you do. And that's what I am. But, you know, like I said, the pandemic kind of helped me focus on video and learn about that modality. And it's just been a great thing to add and help. You know, I love making music videos. I wish MTV was still a thing because I would go all in on making music videos. You know,
right.
It's the most fun I'm having.
Somebody would have to watch broadcast TV.
Yeah,
you could put them in.
Or cable,
on
at
YouTube.
Least.
Yeah, sure.
You'd have to pay for cable. But, so, you know, finding this place, I've been wanting, I've been seeing this building forever. Since I left the music shed, I had a minute to kind of regroup, get myself together, and, you know, become a dad, start my family, and kind of, you know, do that stuff. And I had built a studio in the back of my house, and when we got pregnant, kind of the writing was on the wall that eventually this was going to have to become a playroom. And so my little guy turned 4, and the wife was like, hey, it's time for a studio. And so I started looking for a building. I found this spot, and it was perfect. Right when the street was torn up. So I was able to negotiate really good rent.
Nice. Yeah, it used to be a flower studio or something before that.
Yeah, flower and then like lampshades.
All
kind
of weird
stuff.
Yeah. Now, I'm glad it's a studio. It's a perfect building for it.
It really is.
Beautiful building.
Jeff Treffinger helped me a lot with laying out the space. And
shout out to Jeff Treffinger.
And, you know, helped me translate English to English with the idea of what I wanted to build into how it could be built.
Nice.
So I owe him a lot. Tremendous guy.
Oh, man, we all do. Well, you know, Chris, you're one of those guys I could talk to for the next 4 hours. But, man, he's looking at his watch. It's time to go. He has to get up early.
This has been a great great show for nerds and geeks.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I had a question, though, about Manny. Are you named after the car dealership, or is the car dealership named after you?
No, none of that.
No relation?
No relation.
I think you won that in a card game, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Won that name in a card
game.
Awesome. All right. Well, Chris, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a thrill. So I think this is the beginning of the rekindling of our relationship.
Indeed.
And as always on the Troubled Men podcast, we like to say, trouble never ends.
Yeah, but it could, struggle continues. Good night.
Good night.
Life is indeed a death experience. Hell is ready. On this great big earth, it could be a little taste of heaven. If we only knew our worth, all we got to do. Bad enough to push ourselves through. We always underestimate ourselves. We do it every and I always do better in each and every way. If we don't believe in ourselves, gonna do it. If we don't push ourselves, we'll never make it through it. All you gotta do is want it bad enough. You got to do is want it bad enough. All you got to do is want it bad enough. You might be surprised. Life is a need death experience. Hell is right here on this great big earth, and it could be a little taste of heaven. If we only knew our worth, but all we gotta do is want it bad enough to. You might be surprised.